On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, the robots are here, and they are incredibly, incredibly funny. ABS was the story of MLB's opening weekend. We dive deep into all the strategy, the humor, and the controversy brought about by the robot overlords, and run through every single series from the weekend. Baseball's back, and I am happy again. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world brave enough to admit that it will never be as funny as the ABS challenge system. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. The robots are here, and they are hilarious.
We could aspire to be as naturally comedic as this system introduced to Major League Baseball for the first time in 2026. However, that is a high bar to clear, because my goodness, this first weekend of ABS challenges has given us so much to talk about, and that is why it is, of course, our opener.
The introduction of ABS was much ballyhooed for some time. It was practiced in the minor leagues, implemented in spring training at the big league level in 2025. We saw it at the All-Star game last summer. We saw it this spring training again, but nothing could have prepared us for what we saw this weekend, which was a waterfall, a cornucopia of challenges. We now have data. We now have examples. And it was just so funny, the whole thing. So that is going to be our first segment, is just reviewing the weekend in ABS, because for all of the wins and losses that teams experienced, I think the consensus is no team won more this weekend than ABS, which seems to be an absolute hit with the masses.
A year ago, our first weekend recap show was unfortunately centered on the silly bats. Oh my God, look at those bats. The Yankees are swinging. They scored 500 runs against the Brewers. Are they just going to hit
500? You got swept and will surely stink. The Brewers suck.
Right. The Brewers suck, and Nestor Cortez and Anthony Volpe is going to win MVP. And we were like, what are these bats? We've never seen this before. We were not prepared for that because it was not something we were talking about. And then suddenly we were all talking about it. However, at the time, it was like, well, one, is this even important? Two, the novelty will surely wear off at some point. And three, it all felt like kind of a confluence of events with the Yankees involved and a record number of home runs, where it was just kind of a an eclipse of sorts, where all these things came together and it was like, wow, that really forced us to put all of our attention into torpedo bats. And also they were called torpedo bats, so good branding. However, in some ways, this is an interesting contrast to this, because we've been looking forward to ABS the whole time for years, in fact. And we did a whole episode on it in spring training, contemplating the things that this would do to our game, for better or for worse. And I think what has been most fun about this first weekend, and we already did a whole segment on it after opening day, and here we are again, is that we are constantly revealing more and more. Not just the data itself and what works and who should be challenging and when you should be challenging. That is its own world that is interesting, and we can get into some of that data. But the human element, the emotional component, the performative, the theatrical, I think is the word I'm looking for, component of this system in action in major league games that matter. That is not something that I think we underrated or underprepared for, but we are constantly exploring and revealing more categories of it with every inning, with every challenge, with every game.
Friend of the program, Clinton Yates, said to me, his take on ABS was, I don't like this because I like people. And I want to see people doing the things in our sport. And while I adore that man deeply, I disagreed with that point, because I believed that the robots would reveal more things about people. And that is exactly what we saw over the weekend. That the introduction of ABS does not take the human element out of the game. In fact, it intensifies and amplifies the human element. And that is, I think, what makes it so compelling. Let's get into the stats here, because I do think that is a worthwhile place to start. I am working off of True Media, which is a fancy behind-the-scenes statistical database that we have access to here at Yahoo. And that's just because we're not sure if all the stuff on MLB Savant or on Baseball Savant is updated right now, so I'm just going to go with this. We saw 175 total challenges so far over the first series of the year. The overall success rate is 53.7%. Hitters are hitting 42.3%. Pitchers are 2 for 5. 40%.
Hitting 400.
And catchers are 64.1%. So catchers are the stars of the opening weekend. And I would like to start there. This catcher success rate is higher, I believe, than the catcher success rate at the minor league level. And I know that this is a small sample and things will actualize and maybe that number will go down over time. I don't expect it to go as low as the minor league number was, because I think big league catchers are better than minor league catchers and have a better understanding of the strike zone than minor league catchers do. And so I do think that the catchers, as this moves over time, are going to be the ones that receive these challenges from the team. I think that we may even see some teams say that only the catchers get to use these challenges. Jordan, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that that is something, as you just mentioned, we've barely seen any pitcher challenges, and we've speculated a lot about that. How pitchers, teams have already come out and said it, like, we're not allowing our pitchers to challenge. Some said that at the start of spring training. I believe Pat Murphy was the first to be like, yeah, obviously our pitchers are not going to challenge. Others have slowly adopted that or said, yeah, we probably aren't going to let our pitchers challenge. In some cases, the pitchers themselves are like, no chance am I challenging. That sounds like a terrible idea. I'm just going to trust my catchers. However, we have seen some cases of, you know, they can't help themselves. We talked about Zach Pop on opening day being the first one to pioneer the pitcher challenge and look like a fool doing it.
I mean, think about it this way, dude. If catchers are 22% better at this than hitters, why would you waste them with your hitters?
Well, and that's the question. That was the thing when I was thinking about, okay, when are teams going to challenge? What is the strategy that's going to come up? Quickly, we moved the pitchers to the side. Then we start thinking about leverage. We start thinking about count. We start thinking about inning. We start thinking about game situation. But if we're talking about efficiency and we're talking about trying to get as many right as possible, I do think we could slowly see a push towards, look, we'd rather our catchers be in the better position to make these calls than our hitters. I don't think it'll be completely eradicated, because, again, the moments that we really think about ABS more so, I do think is still more on the hitter's behalf. Which, that's fair to say, right? When we think about the biggest moments where it's like, oh man, I can't wait for the robo-umps, it's hitters getting screwed more than pitchers getting screwed from a optic standpoint, from a fan sentiment, from a fan engagement, emotional reaction. It is more about hitters. So I don't think that eliminating that opportunity completely is smart, but it would not surprise me if the data tells you your hitters are more likely to be wrong than your catchers. And you think about over the course of a season, over the course of these games, and you're just trying to be as right as often as possible and flip as many as often as possible, because you have limited number, if you want to make sure that you have that, or that's why it might be about your hitters. Hey, listen, maybe you can have them in the ninth, but until then, we're not trusting you.
Yeah.
And that's why we're just going to let catchers do it. So that push and pull will definitely unfold for different teams.
Let's move through some of the great moments in ABS from the weekend that was. I think the first ABS showcase play moment day game was CB Buckner against the Cincinnati Reds. Now, when we previewed the season and talked about the 50 people most likely to influence this season, we put CB Buckner on the list. I did not think we were going to be correct immediately, and yet we most certainly were. Jordan, what happened with CB and the Reds?
Well, it's funny the way you phrase that, because you said CB against the Reds, and that is correct, but it also ended up, if you flip it, being CB against the Red Sox because of the ABS challenge system. So I think the way you first described it is accurate, because what was happening is that the Reds were the ones challenging CB Buckner. That is correct. The most notable example being Eugenio Suarez, who challenged back-to-back strike three calls and was inning what would have been inning-ending strike three calls and was correct both times. Now, I don't believe he ended up getting a hit in that at-bat, but what we did have is a consecutive sequence of what we've grown so used to watching in baseball over the years, an inning-ending strikeout. And before ABS, if it was a terrible call, you'd see the hitter say, you know, damn it, throw his helmet down, what the hell, CB, and then you'd go to commercial, right? That's what we're used to. And the, you know, the pitcher would come off the mound and say, all right, got away with that one. Lucky sure. Me, great. CB's behind the plate, cool. However, that is not the case anymore. So instead of Eugenio throwing his helmet, not that Gino is much of a helmet thrower to begin with, of course, one of the nicest people in the sport, he was like, nope, that was not a strike. I'm quite certain of it. So he taps his helmet. Even though CB gave him the punch outside, we go. And sure enough, okay, you're still alive. That's a ball. And then the exact same thing happens on the next pitch, which is really amazing, because we've speculated how the system would change umpire behavior. Would it lock them in more? But also, it's not that simple. If CB could be better from the beginning, he probably would be. So if he saw a similar pitch, he's still just going to call it the way he's seeing it, and instead is forced to reckon with the fact that there is now some supervision that can correct him in front of 30,000 people.
And the most interesting part of this to me was not a bad umpire being bad and getting overturned. It was the crowd reaction at Great American Ballpark in Cincinnati. The place went nuts. It went nuts the first time, and it went double nuts the second time. And I think this is so crucial, because it is not just the system working for the grander truth of baseball, of the fact versus the fiction. It is about entertainment. This is all entertainment. We watch this stuff to be entertained. And that MLB has nailed the communication aspect of this, the presentation aspect of this, both in the ballpark and on the broadcast, out the gate, is an enormous, enormous win. Because it is so quick, it is so intuitive when you see it on the scoreboard or when you're in a stadium, to the point that it then becomes entertainment unto itself. And we get that feedback right away with the way that the fans in Great American Ballpark responded. And so I think, like, to me, that is the takeaway of the weekend. We can dive into the numbers, we can think about the strategy, but the people in the ballpark were entertained by this. Some of that is a novelty, some of that will wear off, but on opening weekend, I don't think this could have gone better for the sport.
Two things on that point. The first is a reminder, and we read this when MLB presented why they are doing this. We read out their exact objective, which their stated great objective point from MLB was this sentence, quote, to provide players with an opportunity to correct missed calls in high leverage moments in a manner that fans like. That is the stated goal of the ABS challenge system from Major League Baseball. And as you just described, I think so far that has succeeded, especially for the paying customers in the building. And I do think that what it feels like in the building is really important, because MLB wants more people to go to baseball games. As we talked about at the end of last week, streaming is its whole mess and watching games on TV is its own mess, and that can remain its own mess that MLB deserves criticism for. But the in-stadium product, which has clearly been improving, as demonstrated by attendance numbers recently, by the pitch clock and all these changes, this is another element, another thing to look forward to when you go to the baseball game. And I think that's the other thing that I want to make sure I stress here, and maybe we did undersell, or not undersell, but not totally grapple with, but it validates one of the points I kept making all spring, which is that you can't replicate these things. Because even when you're testing it in spring training, and you saw it happen in spring training, and I saw it happen in the fall league, we've seen it in those moments. Those aren't real games. You're showing the system, and maybe the people at the spring training game are looking up and being like, oh, haha, okay, you got it right, you got it wrong, all right, whatever. But the leverage doesn't exist because it's exhibition, or because it's, you know, with respect to the fall league competition, there's no stakes, there's no intensity. We're not on the fans are not on their feet at the end of an inning because it's 2 outs and there's guys on. And so when you combine those moments that have naturally existed in baseball for a long time and mix this in, now you're getting these crowd pops for challenges, which we saw in Toronto, we saw in Cincinnati, we saw all of that is great. And that is the part that you clearly would never actually be able to understand until you put it in real games. And that, in that sense, that has outperformed expectations. I do think so.
The other moment, and this is a good transition, is the Orioles versus the Twins on Sunday, where I believe this was the most challenges we had at a game over the weekend. I think it was 10. The Twins currently lead all of baseball in challenges with 11 so far. But we had 10 in that game on Sunday. The first hilarious moment was a Matt Wallner rage challenge, where, and we had a few of these over the weekend, where like the guy hitting is so frustrated by the call that he immediately taps his helmet, even though the pitch, frankly, is not all that close. Matt Wallner does this, and I believe it leads to the Twins not having any challenges left. And this was a dynamic we probably should have talked about with Reds, Red Sox, where like teams did like ran out of challenges and then they couldn't challenge mistakes later on. The Orioles, they hold on to their challenge, and in the ninth inning, with the game close, Ryan Helsley flips in a breaking ball on a 3-2 count with a runner on first to Josh Bell. And Ryan Helsley, as he comes off the mound, the pitch is called a ball. Ryan Helsley, as the pitch comes, he falls off the mound, he kind of like half taps his helmet, or his hat, and the umpire's not looking, and there's like confusion, and then he taps it again. The challenge is given, the pitch is overturned, a walk becomes a strikeout. Twins manager Derek Shelton flies out of the dugout, fuming that Helsley was given the challenge, that he believed that Helsley took too long, right? Mm-hmm. He gets ejected for this. This is kind of our first ejection, challenge-related ejection. Now, this is what's difficult, and we are going to only see this gray area chatted about more. What is the tap of the hat? Does verbal count? If my catcher doesn't do it, do I have to wait for my catcher? How much time do I have? Technically, it's 2 seconds, but the umpire has kind of some leeway there, has some flex. Is the umpire looking at the pitcher? And this is kind of what happens here with Helsley, is I think it was, I can't remember who was behind the dish, not making eye contact with Helsley, looking at the catcher to challenge, misses the pitcher challenge. Does the pitcher then get more time? These are all things that we're going to figure out as things go. But this pitch, I believe, was the most crucial in terms of like WPA of flipping the game, a 2-run game in the ninth, tying run gets aboard. Go back and watch this if you haven't already. It was super interesting what happened at Camden Yards.
So yeah, it was Chris Siegel behind the plate in Baltimore. Laz Diaz was the crew chief. And I mean, Helsley even said after the game, kind of understanding where Shelton was coming from, because of there's just nuance to all of this. And we've seen other situations where Matt Olson tried to challenge a pitch and didn't do it quite fast enough because he had like flipped his bat up in between pitches. And another designation is like, it needs to be your first move, basically. But then we've seen other situations where Randy Arozarena is halfway to first base because he thinks he walked. And when he realizes that it was called a strike, then he challenges it. And then he ended up being correct. But that was well past 2 seconds. And they granted him that. And so that is going to, again, getting back to the human element, that is going to get back to how the umpire is feeling that day, how the umpire has been treated by those teams that day. That is clearly going to make a difference. As we go back to the Reds-Red Sox situation, Alex Cora ends up getting ejected, getting pissed about a check swing call from Trevor Story that CB just gave him right away instead of going down and checking down the lines. It's hard not to wonder if, CB, we already put him on the list anyway before the ABS challenge system, but his feelings during that game as a human, as someone that is trying to manage all, both dugouts and all these things, might be a little bit elevated after having to turn around and be corrected in front of 30,000 people over and over and over. And he might be more willing to say, no, yeah, that's obviously a check swing, or that isn't a check swing, or other calls that you can have. And so there are it is going to be more than just the individual calls. It will maybe permeate throughout. Yeah. And you have to hope that the umpires are kind of able to manage that to the best of their ability. Some are going to be better than that than others. And that's the other part of the data that's always fun. There are some, like Will Little, team, I think it was the Mariners and Guardians, 0-4. Sorry, no chance. Chad Fairchild Chad Whitson, I think it was, whichever game he was in, teams went 7-7 against him. And CB one was 6-8. So you're going to see situations where guys get corrected over and over and over and over, and how that impacts how they are umpiring the rest of the game is something, well, frankly, I'm a little bit concerned about, but it is still part of the entertainment, I think.
And I think umps will adjust their zones slightly. Now, remember, umps are like known for having certain types of zones. Like, oh, his is a little bit wide. Oh, his is a little bit tall. I'm curious to see if those tendencies kind of get reined in a little bit as they get challenged and challenged and challenged and challenged. Two more things I'd like to do before we get out of here and take a break. One is I want to have a running contender for the worst challenge of the year. Now, defining the worst challenge of the year is really two things. It is the moment and it is the pitch. Okay? If we're talking like closest to the center of the zone, there were three challenges from the weekend, Matt Wallner, Nassim Nunez, Denzel Clark, all of which were like very clearly strikes, just bad, bad challenges. But I would like to nominate, and we'll do this King of the Hill style, I would like to nominate Ronald Acuña Jr., who challenged the second pitch of the game on Saturday on a 1-0 count against Michael Wacha, a sinker that caught the outside edge. The ball was almost entirely inside the strike zone, and the Braves birded a challenge right out the gate. Ronald, you're a good player. Maybe not the time to do this. We will keep this moving. We will maybe do this once a week. If we have a terrible challenge contender, okay, we will bring it up against our current champion. And I would like to establish Ronald Acuña Jr. on March 28th on the second pitch of the bottom of the first inning against the Kansas City Royals.
The funniest thing about this clip is it's Salvi, who they just won the WBC together. These guys obviously know each other. And Salvi just looks at him like, what are you doing, man? So I do think that it is going to be way more likely situation based than pitch location based. This one was, it's on the edge, but it's whatever. Those pitches are going to get challenged often much later on in the game. So I agree. Yeah, circumstance, whatever. Yeah. First batter of the game, there's almost no scenario. I guess you're Ronald Acuña, and when you've had this many leadoff home runs, you're probably thinking like, no, dude, come on. This is my time to shine. I got to get the count leverage in my favor.
And I think
it's really hard to imagine that's ever justified.
Acuña is a relevant character here as we move to our last topic, and that is the way, way, way too early challenge usage leaderboard. We're breaking this down by players. Mike Trout leads the league in challenges for hitters. He challenged four times over the weekend, going 3-for-4. Roman Anthony in second with 3. And then Acuña, Schwarber, Gino, Will Benson, Elliot Ramos, Matt Wallner, and Sal Frelick all are at 2 challenges. I am so interested in the fact that Trout is already at the top. Okay. Is he the best player in baseball anymore? No, but he has a lot of juice and he's going to get to use a ton of these challenges.
And hello, like justice for Ronald. Mike Trout also challenged in the, I guess, the second batter of the game, a 0-2 pitch from Tatsuya Imai, and he was wrong. And that was Tatsuya Imai's first career strikeout. And now the Angels are down a challenge two batters into the game. So you could argue that one too, especially in an 0-2 count in some respects. I know that that's like a strikeout versus you're still in the at-bat and it's 2-1 or whatever. But that is also not that far off of what Ronald did. Like I said, any batter challenging in the first inning, it's just hard to argue from a leverage standpoint that is going to make any sense. But yeah, it is cool to see Trout already. And he's also leading the league in walks, which I don't know how many of those challenges have contributed to that. But he's I'm not surprised. He's letting it rip.
And then lastly, we need to talk about one Mr. Edgar Caro. Edgar Caro, the catcher. The Chicago White Sox is leading baseball with 7 challenges already. No one else has more than 4. Now, Caro is 4-for-7 on his challenge attempts. And I am fascinated by this because Caro was the single worst framer in all of baseball last season. And I do not believe it is a coincidence that the worst framer in baseball has the most challenges already, because Edgar Caro is not good at the physical part of catching a baseball and presenting it to the umpire. And if the umpire is going off of the catcher's frame, you would understand why the umpire would miss a lot of pitches with Caro behind the plate. Caro seems to have a decent understanding of the strike zone, even if he has a poor understanding of framing pitches. I love this dynamic. Like, is he going to be number one because he sucks at framing? Are we going to see more terrible framers get shoehorned behind the plate where they know the zone, but their hands suck, and so they end up just challenging all these pitches? Like, Caro to me is the wardrobe to Narnia for this thing going off of the rails a little bit. So keep an eye on him. I'm absolutely, absolutely fascinated.
Yeah, just catching, framing, who's good, who's bad, where does Patrick Bailey, the other end of the spectrum, fit into this? I think we need a lot more data before we totally understand that stuff. But I do think that that flagging Caro this early on is certainly worthwhile. All right, let's take a break. When we return, there was a lot of baseball played. Some teams won all the games. Some teams lost all the games. We're going to start with those teams when we come back.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Let's talk about the results and begin with the sweeps.
Everybody.
There is no shame in getting swept. I never got swept. You guys got swept.
The New York Yankees took all 3 from the San Francisco Giants, winning on Netflix, then winning on Yes, and then winning on Amazon or Fox. Who knows where to watch the baseball? That's not important. The San Francisco Giants scored 1 run over the course of these 3 games. It was an anemic, embarrassing offensive performance. It was a dominant, impressive pitching performance from the Yankees.
Yeah, and, you know, depending on which direction you want to lean into, it's certainly more fun or more spicy to be like, oh my God, Tony Vitello era is a catastrophe so far. Look at all these things Tony's saying after this game and this game and this game. We're going to be doing that all year, folks. Trust me. And I have plenty of Vitello thoughts. But let's give the Yankees some love here. Come on. I mean, Cam Schlittler picking up right where he left off with his epic postseason showing last year, just dicing him up. I mean, this was non-competitive from the Giants. And you can say, well, how good is this lineup? Oh, he's got the ballpark, whatever.
They looked like Schlittler a college looked great. Team.
It sure did, but normally Tony's college teams score a lot more runs than 1 over the course of a weekend. I'll get back to Vitello in a second, but for the Yankees, it was what you wanted to see. I think how good the bullpen was in particular. Will Warren was just okay, but both the A-level guys like Bednar and Doval looks tremendous, but then also like Jake Bird is back and he looked good. Brent Hedrick is getting outs. Like they had anyone that kind of came to the mound for the Yankees pretty much got the job done. And then you get a couple Judge homers. The one on Saturday, why was Ryan Borucki pitching to him with two outs and nobody on? Well, again, bring it back to Tony here in a second, but you know, it was nice to see Judge get on the board there quickly after everyone was making fun of him on opening night and during the WBC. Aaron Judge now has two home runs because, of course, he does. Stanton also has a homer, which was cool to see as well. So it was a pretty just comprehensive, dominant performance from a Yankees team that is one of the best teams in baseball. So we shouldn't be that shocked there.
The Yankees were not great at sweeping teams last year and finishing off sweeps. I think if you are someone like me who picked the Yankees to win the American League, you feel pretty good on Monday morning. Okay, let's talk about Tony Vitello, who made history over the winter by jumping from college ball to MLB from Tennessee to San Francisco. And this could go and could still go in many different directions. But what we did see over the opening weekend was Vitello struggling to contextualize losing three games in a row. He seemed to be pressing a little bit in that he claimed the guys were pressing a little bit. The correct answer to, hey, Tony, you got swept to open the season. The correct answer is probably, well, that's baseball. It's 162 games. But it's important to remember that the college season is what, Jordan, like 58, 65 games?
56 regular season. Yeah.
Okay. And so every win, every loss feels like you're sweeping or getting swept from an importance perspective. And so in Tony's mind, he just lost 9 games. Right? And he will learn this over time as he does more managing at the big league level. But if you want to try and explain why the manager of the San Francisco Giants was not freaking out, but did appear to be somewhat more tense than the typical big league manager after just 3 losses, that is the reason why.
I think it's important to clarify, his most dramatic answer came after the 2nd loss. What he said after they got swept was actually a little bit more low-key. I think his actual managerial decisions in that 3rd game were more curious and... But this is obvious. This is going to happen for all the new managers because this is just how it works. If you're managing for the first time or you're a new guy in that seat, everyone's going to be looking at you and being like, what? What was he thinking there? What was going on there? Well, why did he have
decision making? Yes, but the difference between Tony and Craig Albernaz or, you know, Skip Schumacher, whatever, is that Tony has not ridden the roller coaster of a big league.
Correct. That's absolutely true. But so, yeah, his second after the 2nd loss, he's like, man, yeah, guys are it's a little emotional. He blamed himself being like, I, you know, fire and brimstone speech earlier in the week. I got him too fired up and now we're pressing. And it's like, dude, take it easy. It's going to be OK. You Big mentioned breath. He's not used to it because of his college background. Quite literally, Tony Vitello was never swept at home once as the head coach of the University of Tennessee in 7 seasons of SEC play. So this is an entirely unfamiliar feeling, and that is going to happen at many junctures along the way this year where, as you mentioned, you just don't – it's not a roller coaster. It is a roller coaster, but it isn't because you need to just realize that it is a really, really long season and you're not actually going up and down. And those cliches, we can roll our eyes at all the time. But then when you see it in action, you're like, oh, right, that's why that's a cliche, because it's really true. And you do kind of just got to chill and just take it easy.
Yeah.
And while I do appreciate Tony's authenticity, it's so refreshing and his willingness to just be like, this is how I feel. And this is how he felt after the 2nd game. That transparency and honesty is refreshing for us, but for the purpose of the job and for keeping things steady as the unofficial spokesperson of the baseball team, that is the part of his job that is just so different now. and the part that he's going to have to figure out how to manage. It doesn't mean I want Tony Vitello to suddenly become boring, and I don't think that's ever really going to happen.
Sure.
But for his own sake, we're going to have to kind of keep it keep it a little bit more even keeled.
Yeah. And you can't judge him, obviously, after three games. Whether or not he works out there, whether or not this experiment goes well, is going to rely on how Tony Vitello acclimates to being a big league manager. Let's talk in June and hope that he does not do anything disqualifying until then. I don't think he will. But this is a sign that the acclimation process is going to need to happen, right?
Yeah.
That is my biggest takeaway from this. Just one hilarious other note about this. The Tennessee Volunteers got swept over the weekend, Tony's old club, against Vanderbilt, losing all three games on walk-offs. So
not just all three games on walk-offs. 10th inning walk-off on Friday. 16 innings. Oh, my God, was that game just brutal. 16 innings on Saturday. And then yesterday, a walk-off grand slam up by three is how they managed to lose
to
on Sunday.
So who had a worse weekend? 15, right? On Sunday?
I think, 15 to 14. So who had a worse weekend? The Giants scoring one run and everyone making fun of them? Or the Vols losing three times by walk-off against their rival? Now, that was on the road, obviously, but anyway.
The Giants,
tough.
Because they have so many more games left. Let's stay in the NL West and move out to LA, where the Dodgers began their three-peat quest in dominant fashion, sweeping the Arizona Diamondbacks. Game one, Yamamoto was just okay, but the Dodgers scored enough runs. Game two, Freeland and Mookie go yard. They win by one. We get the first Edwin Diaz save at Dodgers Stadium with a live trumpet. Game three, both Eduardo Rodriguez and Tyler Glasnow were good. Will Smith hits a go-ahead two-run home run on his own bobblehead night and birthday, because of course he does. And the Dodgers win 3-2. This team's still inevitable. It was not just that they swept. It was how they swept. Those wins on Saturday and Sunday are styles of games that we have seen for years now for the Dodgers during the regular season. And this, they are still the Dodgers. They are very much still the Dodgers.
Yeah, you know, they were down by multiple runs. They were down 2-0 in all three of these games, I think. Down 4-0 in one of those games. And it did not matter because this is what the, yeah, I think they were down 2-0 in all three games. And they came back. Shocking. It's hard for the Dodgers to not hard for the Dodgers to score two runs. So here they go. 3-0, nice little start for them. They welcome the Guardians, I believe, this week. Yeah.
What did you think about the Edwin Diaz trumpet situation?
I mean, I know they had my favorite element of it was they showed the bullpen. Yeah, the bullpen catchers. The bullpen catchers having mini trumpets. That's a nice touch. That's something new. That's something I haven't seen. That's whimsical. That's we're buying in. I was in on that. And the live trumpeter, she's good, whatever. It's of course it's not the same. It's you're taking it's still cool. It's fine. But you know, I'm not a Mets fan. I'm not like personally affronted and be like, this is how could they try and rip off? Like, no, it's his thing and it was great. It's fine. It didn't feel as cool as it normally was, but that's really anything is gonna slowly the novelty is gonna wear off.
I liked the live trumpet for the first one, and I think it sounds worse than the recording. Yes. That is not the trumpeter's fault. Baseball stadiums are not acoustic.
She's doing her job.
Utopias.
Yeah.
Like, it's difficult to pull that off. I think they should go with the recording moving forward. Speaking of moving forward, the Toronto Blue Jays moved forward over the weekend, sweeping the A's to win games 8, 9, and 10 of the World Series. That's what it felt like.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that they had to wait until Friday night to open their season after this offseason of trying to move past what happened at the end of October last, I guess November last year, was so cool. And we know what it feels like in that building when it's rocking. And that was what was great, I think, is yeah, it's the A's and you're not playing the World Series right now, but it sure looked like what it sure looked and sounded like the Rogers Center that we just saw in action in October. And that's kind of the energy that the Blue Jays have now. And the coolest part about the weekend is the new guys were doing cool stuff, right? You had Jesus Sanchez hitting his first home run. You had Dylan Cease just dominating with a kind of a new pitch mix that we haven't really seen from him. We saw Okamoto getting his first hit, first homer. So it's just a great blend of the guys you're used to doing cool stuff. Ernie with the walk-off hit and extras on Saturday. You got, of course, Gausman was fantastic, and Springer with the leadoff homer. So you've got the familiar stuff. And then you have Andrés Giménez playing an awesome shortstop. You know, again, we'll talk about Bo Bichette a little bit later. This is not to say that they all like, oh, I'm glad he's gone. No, they'll miss Bo too. But defensively, I mean, this is going to be quite the upgrade for Toronto to have Giménez at shortstop. And he had some fantastic plays over the weekend.
And they were already a sensational defensive team. And now they're upgrading the most important defensive position on the diamond. That is a very, very big deal. The one other thing from this series, Jordan, Steve Kerr's letter to John Schneider. Did you see this? Steve Kerr, the skipper of the Golden State Warriors, just writing a cold letter to John Schneider to say, you did great last October. My favorite part of this was the way he started it. Dear John, I don't know you. Can you imagine if Steve Kerr just ended it there?
But then still signed it, Steve Kerr.
Yeah. I don't know you.
To be clear, this is some great reporting from Mitch Bannon, friend of the show. This was sent like right after the World Series, and John Schneider only just got it because he just got back to Toronto. So this is not like a recent letter. This was something that was written in the hours or days after the Blue Jays lost Game 7. And Steve Kerr, a coaching icon of just in the profession, decided to reach out and be like, hey, this sucks, but guess what? You look like you're pretty good at your job, and I respect and admire that. And if you're John Schneider, that is a pretty cool person to get that letter from. And honestly, as John sort of mentioned in his story, in some ways even better to read that now or recently than when you're still processing it in the immediacy. So that was just an awesome reporting from Mitch and a really cool story.
Dear John, this is Steve Kerr. Why is your face so red, even though you play in a dome? Can you explain that to me? Great job in October. Love, Steve.
We literally have the picture of the letter. So I don't know if there was anything else on the back that had maybe some like tips about certain things, but
sunscreen.
A lot of other jokes I could make, but a lot of other jokes I could make, but I'm not gonna do that. Okay, we have two more sweeps. By the way, the Blue Jays struck out 50 Athletics batters in this series, which is a record for the most in the first two games of the series. Yes, there were extra innings there, but oh boy, not a great showing for the A's offense, if we're being honest. That was super duper hyped, except for Shea Langeliers. And I do want to talk more about Shea Langeliers, but that will have to wait. Let's go to Milwaukee. Folks, the White Sox are still going to be pretty bad. We talked about them getting blown out on opening day, 14-2, and striking out 20 times. Things did not go much better in the second game of the series other than Murakami homering again. Brewers win 6-1. And then on Sunday, yikes, the White Sox jump all over Brandon Sproat. They have a Colson Montgomery grand slam before they even record an out. Murakami homers again. Three games, three homers to start his career. But the White Sox blow a 7-2 lead. Sir Anthony serving up their new closer, who they just gave a bunch of money, serving up a go-ahead pinch-hit home run from Christian Yelich in the eighth inning. I believe Christian Yelich's first pinch hit home run of his career, which is a crazy stat. I do think that the closer coming in for the four out save and not getting out of the eighth inning is one of the more brutal sequences you can have as a manager. It's like, oh man, we got to go to our best guy here so that he can get this last out and then come back out for the ninth. And he didn't even come out for the ninth because just a catastrophic outing from Sir Anthony. And the Brewers win 9-7 and start the season 3-0, which is very different than last year, as we mentioned, when they gave up 500 runs to the Yankees and started 0-3.
However, is this a good sweep loss for the White Sox, who got three home runs from Munetaka Murakami. It is early, yes, but boy, did that look good.
All right, it's like big picture. Okay, White Sox, would you sign up for getting swept in the first weekend if you know Murakami's homering in the first three games? The way they got swept, I would still say no because of just how ugly it was. But it's an interesting philosophical question. Let's finish with one more sweep before we take a break. And that is the Fightin' Fish of Miami, whose hat I am rocking today. However, the more modern Marlins hat that I am wearing today is not the jerseys, the hat, the logo that they were rocking on Sunday when the teal fish. Oh my goodness. This is what they're doing. They're rocking the teal on Sundays, and it looks like a great decision as Owen Casey hits a walk-off two-run homer down by one with two outs in the bottom of the ninth to win the third consecutive one-run game to open the season against the Rockies, sweeping the Rockies. Rockies with only a minus three run differential, but 0-3 nevertheless. What a weekend for the fish, who I think we're going to have a good time watching them.
3-0 to start a season for the first time since 2009. I think that they should just move to these uniforms full time. All these attempts at various blues and oranges and salmons are stupid because you are associated with this color. You have brand identity here. When you see this shade of teal anywhere in the world, and you're like us, you think about the Miami, well, really the Florida Marlins. And I think they should just go back to these full time. Good for the fish who keep on fighting. Let's take a break. And when we get back, we'll talk about all the other baseball games that happen. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. We will go very fast in a moment, but two series that we want to chew on a little bit. So let's go around the league. The Guardians and the Mariners splitting a four-game set in Seattle. We'll get into those specific contests in a second. But first, I'd like to read the home run leaderboard currently in Major League Baseball. With 8, the Angels. Sure. With 7, the Mariners. Right. The White Sox and Nats have 6. The Dodgers, Rangers, Braves, Cubs, and Cardinals have 5. The Brewers, Blue Jays, A's, Pirates, and Guardians rookie outfielder Chase DeLauter have 4. 4 teams have 3. 6 teams have 2. 5 teams have 1, and the Giants don't have any. Chase DeLauter with more home runs than half the league's teams. What a frickin' thing, man.
We talked about his two-homer game on opening day, and that was plenty. You know? Dianu.
Yeah, I was good there.
We could have just been like, Chase DeLauter, well done. You have caught our attention. We will now take you very seriously as the Guardians two-hitter. And he was like, I got one more in me. I got two more in me. As he homers on Friday, and then he homers again on Saturday. The home run that he hit on Saturday was, as I tweeted, simply preposterous. This was a preposterous swing. This was a preposterous at bat, honestly. He had struck out 3 times in the game going into this extra inning plate appearance against Andrés Muñoz, one of the best closers in baseball. And he gets a 2-strike, I think it was a 2-2 fastball up and away that put any other player, let alone rookie, and that's just the pitch you're trying to foul off and hope that maybe Munoz will walk you or hope that you can put a few more pitches on him and extend it. And for a millisecond, that is kind of what it looked like he did when he swung at this pitch up and away. It did not look like, I'm trying to go the other way. It legitimately looks like he accidentally hit a home run. I mean, he basically just kind of swats at this fastball up and away, and it just goes over the fence in left field for a go-ahead homer. I was in shock. I was up just watching this. Yeah. This is, it's like 1 a.m. at this point, right? And I just couldn't believe it. I was just, this is absurd. So Guardians win that. That was a heck of a win for Cleveland on late Saturday night. Mariners come back on Sunday Night Baseball and dominate 8-0. But DeLauter is the story of the weekend, without a doubt.
It is also somewhat telling that DeLauter has 4 home runs and the Cleveland Guardians have, as a team, 4 home runs. He has all the home runs. That is why this series was a split and little more.
How long will that ratio sustain? As I mentioned, Cleveland going to Dodger Stadium this week. Roki tonight. How does Roki look? Roki versus Chase DeLauter is a very funny matchup for a lot of reasons. And we will see
how that
goes. As for the Mariners, I will go ahead.
DeLauter plus Jose Ramirez have what percentage of the Guardians home runs at the end of the year?
Oh man. If they're gonna hit like 100,
they hit 180.
I'll say 180 would be, I don't know how many they hit last year, but 180 sounds like a lot. I'll say 29%. Might be more than that.
Okay.
29%? That was like some real quick math.
Sounds right.
I don't know how bad of an quick estimate that was, but we will see. Quickly on the Mariners, like Emerson Hancock, 6 no-hit innings. That's a big deal. I mean, I know, again, Cleveland's offense, as we just mentioned, besides Chase DeLauter, who's going to win MVP, not awesome. But if Emerson Hancock can be a like actually finally good starting pitcher, that is a big deal because Bryce Miller is injured and they don't really have any depth behind them. So that is a sneaky big deal for Seattle. All right, one more series we wanted to highlight before we go super fast. And that is the one that you saw the opener of. That is the Mets and the Pirates. We know that the Skeens catastrophe on opening day, we don't have to talk about that anymore. However, the woes continued for Pittsburgh in the second game of this series as a real nail biter, 0 runs for either team in regulation. This kind of felt like the game that the Pirates are going to win, right? This is the recipe for the Pirates, even if they've improved their offense a little bit, is to keep it close and then maybe score on the road in extras. And that is what happened in this game. However, it did not end in a good way for them as Luis Robert Jr. hits a walk-off home run to win 4-2 in extras in 11 innings to give Luis Robert his first kind of signature moment as a New York Met.
Pirates come back and win the game on Sunday. Brandon Lau's 3rd home run as a Bucco. Neither of these teams played well over the weekend. This was bad baseball, frankly.
Yeah.
Spring training mode, still engaged. Neither the Mets nor the Pirates really deserved to win game 2 or game 3. So I'm happy that they split them. We had a bang, bang play at home plate in the Sunday game for the Mets where someone was thrown at home plate in the 10th inning, yada, yada, yada. The most interesting takeaway from this series is that Bo Bichette has been terrible. Now it is just 3 games, so who cares? But Bo heard the Bo Birds, wink, the Boo Birds on Sunday from the Mets fans. And I need to give Bo Bichette some credit. Okay. Getting booed in your 3rd game with a new franchise cannot feel good. And I don't think you can handle this from a PR perspective any better than Bo did. He said, quote, "If anything, I thought it took too long. I get it. I thought my at-bats were terrible too." He said it with a, you know, very likable grin on his face in a way where it was clear that he was aware that he had been bad and also was aware that it wasn't that big of a deal. There is a way to answer this question where it becomes like an exhausting problem for you over a 2-week span in New York where the media cycle gobbles you up. This was the opposite of that. Can this guy play in the Big Apple? Conversations are usually silly. The way that Bo responded to this made me feel incrementally better about how things will play out for him with the Mets, which is maybe silly, but whatever.
Yeah, I think it bought him some leeway. I don't think, but it's still whatever. If he sucks for another week and he's still batting third, like people are still going to be pissed. So, I mean, this is well done. I agree. He handled it as well as he could. And I don't think Bo Bichette is suddenly bad now because he went 1-for-14 with 8 strikeouts. But, you know, yeah, it's he's still when you're the guy making whatever he's making, then, yeah, people are going to care. So, but I agree. He crushed it. Well done. Good job, PR, for Bo Bichette. Very, very impressive stuff, which is also refreshing. I guess maybe that was the best part. It was like the Mets, even in this new era, I have still found so many ways to bungle PR, whether it's their own players, whether it's their own manager, whether it's front office GM. Like,
sure.
This is just constantly, we're talking about things that a Met shouldn't have said, or this. And instead, Bo Bichette, he's like, well, I got this thing covered. I got this part under control. I think he gets bonus points for that. I thought that was very well done. All right, Jake, we have 8 more series and not a lot of time. It's time to go fast.
Faster than fast, quicker than quick. I am lightning.
I feel the need for speed.
It's turbo time.
Tigers take 2 out of 3 over the Padres in San Diego. We had Kevin McGonigal, the rookie, 4 hits in game 1. He has a huge big hit in game 2 after getting a home run robbed by Jackson Merrill. Tigers take that one. The Padres avoid the sweep with 6 scoreless innings from Randy Vasquez, one of our favorites, the man who hates a strikeout and loves a strike, not a walk, is throwing harder and his stuff is better. 6 scoreless, 8 strikeouts from Randy Vasquez. Clap it up for Randy.
Randy Vasquez last year, 78 strikeouts in 133 innings. So for him to start off this season with this kind of gem, what Craig Stammen, I think, was saying, his best outing as a Padre in his third season was fantastic. We love Randy Vasquez. Let's go to Cincinnati. As we mentioned, C.B. Buckner was the star in game 2 here. However, the Reds, after getting shut out on opening day, come back with a pair of close victories in 2 and 3. We've got the Dane Meyers walk-off single in that second game in the 11th, and then Gino with the big go-ahead homer in game 3 after a solid Rhett Lauder start. So not the best showing for the Boston offense. I think regardless of all the ABS drama, I think that is certainly a takeaway so far for the Red Sox, who dropped the series to the Reds.
Angels and Astros played 4 games at Daikin Park in Houston, and my takeaway is that both of these teams are going to stink. One of the preseason coat hooks that I had was that the Astros were going to be bad, that they were going to finish under 500, and even though they split the series, Jordan, I got to be honest, I feel pretty good about that take because they did not look crisp. Angels take the first 2 in the series. The Astros win the last 2, but both of those were just slop fests. And I come away just being like, this is good for the Mariners.
Yeah, the only, and Rangers, we'll get to you in a second here. I think the most encouraging thing from the weekend for Houston was Yordan. Like, Yordan looks like Yordan. And that is exciting. Now, how much is he going to get pitched to ever? Probably not much. But he was hitting the ball hard.
I think he was intentionally walked 3 times.
He was. That is correct. He was intentionally walked 3 times. He's got 1 real homer and 1 homer that hit the roof that should have been a homer that didn't count. So Yordan, you're feeling good about. Brian Abreu throwing 92 and looking terrible. That's not good. Tatsuya Imai will give him some grace. First career start. That might take some time. Hunter Brown was good, not great. Burrow's kind of getting knocked around. Javier getting knocked around. And then the Angels, it's just, they're going to hit a bunch of homers like they did last year. The defense is awful. They're still striking out a bunch. The pitching is not good. That's not a surprise. So they're, like we said, if Trout is back and wins MVP like Jake boldly predicted, maybe they will be closer to okay. But the totality of the baseball team was not something that I think we feel good about at all. And that is, I guess that's what a 4-game split looks like for those 2 teams.
3 of the 11 intentional walks so far this season belong to Yordan Alvarez. And
love that.
what's important about him as a character is that he appears dangerous. When he's on, no hitter in the league is like more dangerous, more imposing, more fearsome. And that he has enough of that aura immediately to convince the Angels to intentionally walk him three times is telling to me.
It's not just when he's on, like his in-box presence. I don't really know. Yeah, of course, Ohtani and Judge, whatever. When he's in there and he just roped the ball of the at-bat before, and he's got that like twitch. He's got like his butt, like his hips kind of like turn a little bit, and he's just like ready to
like, this guy's going to hit 1,000 for the rest of his life.
This guy is horrifying. And that is the most, that is a compliment in the highest of senses. He is amazing. I'm so glad he's back. Like his at-bats are must watch. But if he's intentionally walked every time, they are going to become not as interesting. All right, let's go to the Cubs, where former Astro Alex Bregman logged his first two. Remember when he was on the Astros? That was a couple teams ago now. Alex Bregman, two-homer game in the series finale here. Not enough as the Washington Nationals take this first series here in Chicago. And I do think it is impressive and you got to give them credit because coming into the season, we had these three teams at the bottom that there was no doubt. I guess the Angels were sort of part of this conversation. But if you look at preseason power rankings, what you're going to see are the Nationals, White Sox, Rockies at the bottom. And the White Sox and Rockies got swept in sort of embarrassing fashion, slightly different ways. And the Nationals went into Wrigley Field and won two of three baseball games. Yeah. And the wind played a factor and there was some goofy stuff going on. But I don't know. They found a way to win a series, and I'll give them credit for that. It doesn't change that I think they're still going to finish in last place, but I thought it was good. It was good for them.
I mean, they have the best player in the world. That certainly helped.
One of,
Joey Weimer.
Yeah, he's right there. Joey Weimer. Yeah.
Joey Weimer reaches base in his first six plate appearances with the team, the first player in franchise history to do so. First player in Nats Expos history to hit hit homers in each of his first two games. He was eight. His eight first eight plate appearances. Eight. You reach base.
Yeah, he's still got the 1,000 OBP with eight plate appearances. Wow. So yeah,
he walked into Chicago and put ketchup on his Weimer, and everyone was mad. Nailed it.
I have nothing to add to that. That is a great line. Cubs, you're going to be just fine. All right, let's go back to Baltimore, where the Orioles did win this series. The Twins taking the second game as the Orioles offense just did not show up at all against Taj Bradley in the anonymous Twins bullpen. But the Orioles come back from a 4-0 deficit in the series finale with the ABS drama included. And Ryan Helsley, he's going to get a lot of saves this year. That was something I already believed coming into the season, but I certainly believe it after this first weekend.
The Orioles are going to be pretty good. They need to figure out their bullpen mix, who they trust late in games, who they don't. Anthony Nunez is a fascinating character who we will spend more time on at a podcast in the future. I think he's going to end up getting some high leverage opportunities. I also think we haven't talked about the Shane Baz extension, which happened since we last recorded. I went to that press conference on Saturday. This is just notable because the Orioles are doing all of the things that we were critiquing them for not doing, signing big free agents, extending their players, renovating their stadium. It was interesting to sit in the room as Shane Baz got his extension and watch Adley Rutschman and Gunnar Henderson and all the other Orioles who were in the room, but particularly Gunnar and Adley watching an Oriole sign an extension, right? It's like, that's the big one. Shane Baz is good to have around, especially if you believe that he's going to be better than he's been. But the future of this organization rests upon the ability to keep those guys around. I am a little skeptical because Gunner is represented by Boris, but we will see. Rangers taking 2 out of 3 over the Phillies in Philadelphia. Phillies taking game one. Christopher Sanchez, wonderful across 6 innings. Jacob deGrom scratched with neck stiffness before game two, but Jacob Lats fills in admirably, and the Rangers win 5-4 and 10. Mackenzie Gore better than Jesus Luzardo in the finale, and the Rangers take this series.
Yeah, no, it was a pretty impressive showing. The DeGrom news sounds like not a big deal, so let's really hope that that's the case. the fact that he was the only pitcher to not no, the only Rangers pitcher to not go on the IL last season is still one of the goofiest fun facts that we've had in a while. So let's hope that this is a minor thing and he can get back to pitching well, because that is their path to being solid. And if we do believe that the Astros and Angels are, and certainly A's or maybe behind schedule, there could be an opportunity for the Rangers to be relevant in this division, especially like Jake Berger getting on the board too. That's really important to have him be an actual part of that offense. Nimmo getting his first homer, Kutch getting his first homer with the Rangers. So some signs of life after getting dominated by Christopher Sanchez, signs of life from the Rangers offense in those two games. Certainly a good sign. Two more series. We go to Atlanta, where the Braves taking 2 out of 3 over the Royals after they won the opening day game on Friday behind a great Chris Sale start. Saturday was, oh boy, this was one of the lower points of the weekend in terms of just process and results and just sequences, at least for the Kansas City side. That's Carlos Estevez, their closer, who has very notably been throwing much slower for the entirety of spring training and the WBC, both before he left and at the WBC. And then when he came back, the guy who's normally 95-96 has been throwing 90-91. And he came in with a 2-run lead on Saturday night. And you were just like, well, if he's throwing 90-91, that's not going to be good enough. That's exactly what happens. The Braves just completely put together a rally fairly quickly. And Dom Smith hits a walk-off grand slam to win 6-2. Hell yeah. Awesome moment for Dom Smith, who I believe lost his mom to cancer just a few weeks ago. So Dom's one of the best in the biz. So awesome to see him just like still around getting big league jobs and finding a role on this Braves team that could use some help on offense in terms of the bottom of the lineup with Profar being out and some of the other issues that they have. So really cool to see for Dom Smith. And clearly Estevez is not right. He also took a comebacker off the ankle in that inning. So I don't know how much we're going to see him recently, but they do, or in the near future, but they still have Lucas Ersig. So that is good for them. And Lucas Ersig closed out the Royals' first win of the season on Sunday. The Braves had a tough day at the plate from a BABIP perspective. A couple deep flyouts for them. Carter Jensen hits his first homer as the Braves do not sweep. And Mikel and Ronald Acuna Jr., I'm sure, enjoyed a nice post-game meal, as they are cousins and WBC champions.
Cardinals taking 2 out of 3 over the Rays in St. Louis. This series was just completely off the rails. What a perfect introduction to the Ryan Stanek experience, both in game one and in game two for the St. Louis faithful. The Cardinals win both of those games. JJ Weatherholt walk off 2 RBI single in the bottom of the 10th. Like, we've gotten to know JJ a little bit, dude, over the last couple of years, and I could not be happier for him. What a good dude. He is a special player and exactly the type of person that you want to, you know, build your franchise around. So for him to get on the board like this and be a story out of the gate is very, very cool.
A lot of, you know, MLB history fun facts that happened over the weekend. I'll do this one and then you could finish with this this Rays fact that you tweeted last night. I believe JJ is the first player ever to homer in his first game and have a walk-off in his second game. So there you go. Pretty decent start to his career for JJ Weatherholt. But Cardinals pitching, nah, I'm not so sure about that. And they allowed how many hits to the Tampa Bay Rays over the weekend?
Jordan and I are both married, but we appreciate singles nonetheless. The Tampa Bay Rays hit 35 singles over the weekend. 35 singles over their first three games. That is the most singles in a team's first three games since the 1952 Dodgers hit 38 across their first three. Let me say that again. No team has ever hit this many singles to start a season since the literal Brooklyn Dodgers. Okay? Eisenhower was president, and here's Chandler Simpson beating out ground balls.
I think the funniest part is whenever the Rays do anything weird, it's like they're onto something. This is their brilliant next level genius progressive strategy. And to think that the Rays spent the whole offseason being like, okay, how are we going to get back into the mix? We are only going to hit singles.
Singles.
I was like, they only had one homer.
They had 41 hits, which leads baseball.
Five doubles.
One homer, five doubles, 35 singles. Just again, just to put this in context, they have 35 singles. The Brewers have 24. They're in second. Okay. No one is more single than the Rays. They're swiping right as much as they possibly can.
Well, and the Mariners have eight homers,
six,
seven doubles, three. How many? They barely have any
singles. Mariners have four games. They had a lot of singles. They had a lot of singles yesterday. They've played more games. They're up to 11 singles, but I believe through the first couple games, they had zero singles. They were very locked up.
Yeah.
They were cuffed in a relationship.
Have 13 hits. All right, we're done. That's it. Our first recap edition of Baseball Barbacast. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and TJ Brassel for producing. We will be back on Wednesday, I believe, with a very special guest. Oh, boy. You can email us baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Until then, talk to you soon.